Welcome back, everyone, for Caster Calls with Zombie Grub. It's episode, is it episode 60? Or is it episode 70? Shoot, I've already forgotten. This is the hardest part about doing the intros. But it's a zero somewhere. So welcome back, guys. I think it's episode 60. There we go. And I have Necro with me. So it's been a little while since I've done this, but very happy that I can get Necro on, especially because you were so nice, apparently.
Oh, thank you.
You were talking about this, so I really appreciate that. And just, you know, it's awesome having you on. Definitely watched some of your career with the Overwatch. I think was a big move for you. But then also, you're clearly into Pokemon. So we'll definitely get to talking about that. That's all your background. And as well as anything else esports-wise that you have done. But as usual for the show, please just kind of tell us how you got into video games and how you got into esports.
Hey, well, first off, thank you so much, Zombie Grub, for having me. I'm really excited to be here. And I guess, yeah, we'll talk a little bit about what happened. Because honestly, I don't know sometimes when I look back on my career and try to figure out where I started and how I got here. But I guess things just kind of fell into place. And as building blocks started to come to fruition, you know, starting with volunteer casts for Overwatch and then trying to transition from that into full-time work, I guess things just kind of came together. I don't know how else to put it.
It's not an unfamiliar story. You know, a lot of the people who get into esports, they kind of just fall into it and decide to run with it. But I guess, were you always a person who played video games growing up?
Definitely. Okay. I have so many fond memories of, like, my brother just kind of teaching me the ropes of, like, the Nintendo 64 or the GameCube and like, having my own Game Boy Advance and just kind of playing by myself. And then it just transitioned into trying to play a little bit more competitively with Overwatch, Hearthstone, always been kind of, like, a competitive Blizzard fangirl. And then I found out that you could talk about that kind of stuff for a living and tried to see what I could make do in that area.
When did you become aware of that, of the esports thing?
It was BlizzCon 2018. I went because I had never experienced a BlizzCon before, and then seeing the big stages for StarCraft and for the Overwatch World Cup, it just all started to make sense to me. I didn't really know that you could have those types of productions, and I didn't really know it was called esports until I saw that on the big stage.
Wow, you might be the newest face esports that I've had on. I think Frankie was also kind of new-ish, but I think she was even like 2017. So
yeah,
you hit the new goal. So 2018, and here you are 4 years later working with the Overwatch League. That is a tremendous leap forward. Really, so many other people obviously will talk about years and years and maybe even like not in the game they originally did. So yeah, 2018, you figure this all out. Was there like a spur of action? Did you suddenly just go like, this is what I'm going to do? And you just did a bunch of stuff?
I kind of. Whenever I got home, I just said, I like esports. I just like esports as a whole. I don't know what I really wanted to jump into in terms of working in the industry. So I tried everything. I tried social media management. I tried talent management. I don't know how I found myself in that area yet. I tried being on camera. I tried being behind the camera doing production. And it just seemed to be that talking about video games seemed to be the thing that opened the most doors. So I just ran with it.
Wow. And what did you start doing? Like, did you start with Overwatch? Did you try the other games?
I did. So I tried to stick to things that I had individual competitive experience with because I felt like that would be the most natural transition. And so Overwatch was the first thing that I started where I was already working with a smaller grassroots community called Owlet. Because we wanted to try to make something that was like a mini owl for people that were like gold and flat. Because I don't think most of those people will probably make it to the Overwatch League, but it still gave them that kind of competitive experience. And we started running our own production. So I tried casting through that. And then some people asked me if I knew Hearthstone. And so I started doing that too, because that was another natural avenue for me. And just started following the steps like that.
Okay, so getting your fingers in a lot of pies, actually kind of just beep up and around. When did you first get paid?
My first paid gig was for the Hearthstone gig that I was scouted for. So that was Bemi Esports that had reached out to me after seeing my work with Owlet and asked me if I knew Hearthstone. And so I did WESG, and that was my first paid gig.
Cool. Yeah, that's a popular name. Okay, so then, I mean, what round was that? Like, how long are we talking about into your casting career?
That was 2018. That was, right so away.
Very quickly. Yeah. Very quickly, dang. And then, okay, at some point, I guess you got into Pokemon commentating, hosting?
Yes. So I was a player from 2014 to 2016, and this was right around the time I was finishing up college. So I had a bunch of friends that were driving to events like St. Louis, Indianapolis. I went along with them and had a couple of my own competitive experiences. And then I took a break because I didn't like the meta. I thought it was super toxic and just unfun to play. And when I came back to it, it was after I had discovered broadcasting and just, and commentating. So I reached out to Rutgers University, see if they had any openings for me to just do some volunteer work with them. And then Pokemon Company reached out to me and brought me on for the North America International Championships in 2019. And that's kind of the timeline of, I guess, WESG happened first and then the Pokemon Company work.
Wow. Again, very, very fast still. It's not common. So excuse me for being a bit bewildered. It's not because of your skill that. It's just the careers of many others. Do not get to that quickly into certainly the paid gig, but then certainly not by being reached out to by the main developers. Also, usually a very big deal. A little hiccup tech wise. I was asking you, when did you get picked up by the Overwatch League, and how was the experience of getting picked up by them?
Yeah, so I still was very eager to pursue Overwatch content and broadcast, despite the fact that I was diversifying by doing Hearthstone and also Pokemon. And so I also found a way somehow into the Broadcast GG server that was at the time still working on Overwatch productions. So they were covering Open Division. They also had a contract to do content for Contenders China. And so after doing a few seasons of Open Division, I was then asked to do analysis work for Contenders China, and then went from there to Contenders Europe and North America, and then Overwatch League this year.
Which is still a big step up. I mean, especially considering that Overwatch League from the get-go kind of hired the cream of the crop, the biggest names a lot of the time. And would still do so. I mean, I think up until basically the last 2 years where they started actually picking people out of the Contenders lineup and bringing them up. So what was the feeling at that point? Did you feel like you made it? Or was it kind of one of those like, well, this is kind of the natural step, so I don't know.
Overwatch League was always my goal. And so finally getting an offer for it, it felt like, yeah, like I made it. But also, do I deserve it? I had a lot of that imposter syndrome of, look at all the people that walked before me, you know, Monty, Doa, Wolf, like all of these big names and talent that I heavily look up to. And so it was weird to find myself in the position where I was a new piece being added to a duo. And I was the only person that was being added that didn't have that established partnership, because I also came up with Lemon Kiwi and Leg Day, who are very established in the Overwatch space. So it was a lot of things at once when I got the offer, where there was that excitement, but there was also that nervousness.
Yeah, I think that's very understandable, especially again, because your career was so fast paced.
It's new. Yeah. It still feels very new. Like it was yesterday.
It kind of running and not exactly catching up, but kind of just, I feel like there might be a lot of excitement and nervousness that goes along with that, compared to, I guess my journey was always so slow. By the time that I made it, it was kind of one of those for me, like, yeah, no, of course. I actually didn't have much imposter syndrome, but it's what 7 years of doing it first would perhaps do. But you come in and do a wonderful job. And it seems like everything's working out quite well as far as your career in esports. So is there any other like steps, milestones that I might have missed? Because of course, I only have an overview of your career.
I really think that those are the big ones. I think, you know, when I look at my career and I look at it in years and in chapters, the first thing was just doing the unpaid volunteer work. But I guess I am also personally surprised at how little time it felt like it took to have that first big door get opened up with the Pokemon company and where that has taken me since, because I feel like I'm not the first talent to even be able to take an opportunity like that and just like kind of blow it up into a career. Because it wasn't until that point that I realized that I might be able to make a full-time career out of it.
Yeah.
It was that one big opportunity that was like, okay, well, maybe there is a chance now.
So I think asking you about some of the growing pains of learning about commentating is going to be very interesting again, because it was so fast. I guess, first of all, do you consider yourself more of a play-by-play or a color commentator?
It depends on the game. So for Pokemon, I actually do play-by-play commentary. But for Overwatch League, I do the color commentary. Mm. And it's just based on the pacing and where I feel like I can best fit my voice.
Okay.
For Pokemon, it was kind of an interesting one. I only started out there because I felt like I didn't have the knowledge necessary in order to do a good enough job with color commentary to make it the right fit. But for Overwatch, it's like I had played competitively for so long, and that was the first opening that I got to where they said, well, you're going to do color commentary. And I said, okay, well, my choice has been made up for me. And that's really where I decided to slot myself in for broadcasts past Open Division.
Okay, cool. Did you have a background in anything to do with broadcasting or being up on stage or anything?
No, I didn't. I actually came from a bachelor's of science. Like, that's where I got my education. And I always thought that I was going to go into doing academia or something where I guess public speaking is involved, where you're in front of like a class or you're giving a poster presentation. And so I did have some amount of skill from that, but I didn't realize that some of that would be able to transfer over.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think it does. I mean, obviously, a lot of people have a very troublesome first step. Like, they literally cannot get in front of people. So that would obviously be something that a lot of people have worked on.
Yeah.
So I think that is kind of a background. But yeah,
it
when
helps,
you
but
yeah, when you talk to people,
I guess you would think traditionally,
yeah, who have been in debates or literally were like going to be broadcast jockeys or you know, they were literally in the public speaking club or whatever it is. It's just, yeah, there's a lot of the uneducated necessarily, but the untrained, right? That
yes,
that train themselves, that educate themselves, that come into esports, and you had to do it, you know, really, really quickly. So, you know, what were some of the things that you remember kind of fixing first, I suppose? So you get on the mic for the first time and you're like, this sounds really cool, and I think I can kind of, you know, mimic what I heard other people doing. What was it like actually doing it at first, though?
It's incredible how much else goes into broadcasting beyond just getting in front of a camera and talking that people don't know about. You know, there's the prep work that goes into it to make sure that you know what you're talking about. And there's also the cadence that you develop from, you know, listening to sportscasters or other casters that you admire and just kind of trying to pick up on what do I like that they do. And so for me, the first thing was just becoming confident enough to sound like I knew what I was talking about, because I knew that I had the knowledge, but it was about using that knowledge and taking it and actually translating it that I feel like was the biggest hurdle to overcome.
Right. Do you remember what you did to learn how to do that?
I think it was just persistence.
Okay.
I think it was just persistence and doing a lot of practice and then VOD review. Because that was the only way I would ever figure out if I liked what I sounded like and if I liked what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I think, the biggest thing that I could have done.
Were there any mentors or people that you looked up to who could provide some insight into this?
I had a lot of practice sessions with people in Broadcast GG that had more years of experience over me. So I remember one of the first VOD reviews I ever did was with Boopasaurus. So he's a TFT caster. He was also doing Overwatch casting for a long time. And so it was great to just even hear feedback from somebody else that had those years of experience where, okay, this was good, but you know, I could work on this, or I just remember those first few lessons and that was really helpful. But then also being able to do VOD reviews with people like Uber. I still do VOD reviews with Uber and he still helps me to this day. And so it's cool to see the progress from the first time I ever did a session with him up to now doing it from cast in the Overwatch League.
Yeah, that's awesome. Both have been on the show and they just always were so excited and I guess very, very lovely people as well.
Very because passionate.
They wanted to talk so much about improving the people that are coming up, you know? They're not just sitting there and like knocking people down the ladder. They very much are focused on improving and improving the craft and improving the industry as well. So do you remember you know, from Uber's VOD reviews, whatever recent one, maybe even some of the biggest points that you, maybe your biggest weaknesses that he gave some really good advice to help you improve on?
Yes. So the last VOD review I've had with him was actually when we were in Toronto, right about to do our first cast of the day for the Summer Showdown. And so that was in front of a crowd again. And I got really excited because being from the remote environment for majority of the season, I just couldn't wait to finally be able to cast the way that I feel like esports is meant to be casted in front of the people that can give you those genuine hype reactions and immediate feedback on whatever is happening in front of them too. And you get a chance to kind of help craft that environment and you get to feed off of that energy too. And so right before we went on, we actually sat and we watched some of the most recent casts leading up to the Summer Showdown. And he was saying, one thing that you could do to really hit home the points you want to make is by pointing out something the audience should keep an eye out for. What is the one thing that you feel like could make or break this matchup? And how can you communicate that so that the audience can find those moments that you want to refer back to? Leave yourself that breadcrumb so you can pull it through the rest of the cast to be able to refer back to it and to make the audience feel like they are learning with you about something really cool about the matchup.
That's awesome. And it sounds like it's more specific as well to the color, even though Uber's the play-by-play.
Yes. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he just knows a lot about the craft in general, so it's not surprising. But it's awesome that it was kind of focused in that direction, right? Because it would be all too easy to tell someone, he's like, I don't know how to work with a crowd, and be like, just be excited with them, right? Which
exactly,
you know, is part of it. But to specify what a color commentator can do to build that excitement, other than just being loud and excited with the other guy, is really, really important. Very good advice. So you worked with the crowd. This is past tense. What were your feelings doing with the crowd? Because this is a fascinating thing for me because I came up, obviously, with a lot more lands. Mm-hmm. And then I'm talking with people who, have gotten into things recently and thus had 2 years I have a 4-year career that was just literally online. So there's a lot of the, I just really wanted to get to a crowd and you guys finally get to, right? So how was that? How did the experience work out?
It's amazing because for every Pokemon that event that I've done, except for that 2-year break, it was always in person. So North American International Championships in 2019 was the first time that I really felt like I had the audience in front of me that I could work with. And then, you know, a lot of that quickly disappeared. So it was interesting, you know, having that first taste of being able to feed off of that energy and try to incite excitement or not, you know, maybe you're trying to play to the team that's maybe against the home crowd, who knows? You got to get that antagonistic energy also out there too. But it was just relieving almost in a way to be able to have that experience again. And also just, an exciting one.
Yeah, it's great. And I hope that esports continues to do lands and have the casters with the crowd, because unfortunately there's a bit of a trend elsewhere, but yeah. I think it's very important for the casters. I think the fans love it as well. There's no doubt about that, but perhaps a discussion for later. focusing on your building career and your improvements that have had to have happened in leaps and bounds, and it's a short career overall. Do you remember working specifically with the play-by-play aspects of your casting? So the Pokemon, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I'm still very much a novice. I do not quite get it. Plus, there's so many Pokemon games. There's the Pokemon game, there's Pokemon Go, there's so card much. Game. I've talked to a few people, so I have like a better understanding. But anyways, play-by-play for that. You know, what does Pokemon play-by-play look like, first of all? If you can give us kind of a vague description. And then second of all, what were some of the growing pains that you found when trying to be a play-by-play?
Oh, I have a lot for that. But I guess the way that I would describe Pokemon play-by-play best is you have... So the Pokemon for the video game is turn-based. So mm-hmm. you have a set amount of time where the players 1v1 can take their turns. And then you have the animation sequences of how those turns play out. Mm-hmm. There's obviously more nuance there in terms of how fast those Pokemon move and how they interact with each other. But it's basically like watching 4T chess in a way. Okay. So when you do the play-by-play, you know, the very first way that I approached it, because I didn't have a lot of experience, was just, I'm going to talk about what's on screen. Because maybe I'm not, you know, I wasn't confident enough with what else I could bring to the table beyond, well, you know, Pikachu is using Thunderbolt and the Eevee responds by using Protect. Like, it was very, very layman's of what I would expect from a play-by-play experience from like the top of esports talent. But that was how I felt I could be most comfortable to do the bare minimum of the job that I was hired to do, but also give myself something to work with so that I could make improvements for later. And I quickly found, though, that I was not ready for the North American International Championship stage. I made a lot of knowledge mistakes during that cast that people still like to call upon to make criticism for my casting. Mm-hmm. And it was not until recently that I felt like I finally had done enough improvement that people were noticing. And they started to not make those same types of criticisms. It was actually kind of therapeutic. I try my best to stay away from like YouTube comment sections or Twitch chat or Reddit or whatever, just for my own mental health. But I, for some reason, was overcome by just interest into the YouTube comment section of one of the most recent Pokemon streams that I had done. And I'd actually seen a lot of people that said, I used to really not like her, or I used to be an avid Necra hater, but she's put in a lot of work and it shows. And I was like, I feel like that's the biggest compliment I could have ever received, is having that journey from that 2019 play-by-play era of really not understanding the craft well enough, and also just not understanding the game enough to a high level that I can see the progression from that to now.
Right. And that's a great feeling. But it must have been kind of daunting because, I mean, you did get kind of pushed to a very big stage fairly early on in your career. So when you said you tend to avoid it, are we talking about back then literally making sure to avoid all comments? Or did you have to deal with it and digest it and, you know, work through it?
It was kind of a mixture of both. I think that I, at the time, was trying to be more confident than I was, at least trying to portray confidence more than I felt confident, only because I felt like I kind of needed that being pushed to such a large stage so early. Kind of fake it till you make it, sort of.
Yeah.
And after I did that, I realized, though, that all the criticism that I was getting was warranted. But it was, you know, that part of me that was like, no, it's not. Like, I did fine. And you know, trying to convince yourself that what you did was enough. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the comments that were maybe more mean-spirited still held inklings of truth.
Right.
And so it was difficult at first, but necessary for me to essentially try to figure out a way to sift through the negativity to find those nuggets that would actually help me improve as a person and also as a broadcaster. Yeah. When I finally did that, it felt like I had opened up a whole new door of possibilities for where I could take my commentary. So now it's not about just stating the obvious with people with eyes can see what's happening, but also trying to include things that like my color caster can pick up on to expand upon further when we do have that break where the players are figuring out their next turn.
Right. A little more back and forth, a little bit more of an alley-oop for your color commentator. That's a fantastic way of looking at it. And I feel like that is a humongous hurdle that, as you said, like if you can work through it, come out the other end like a better person, but also more flexible for any other approach to esports, is that's fantastic. And it's also very true that there are just occasionally, if enough people say something, even if it's all mean-spirited, that it's got a kernel of truth in it.
Probably something there.
Yeah. Which is sometimes a harsh acceptance, a harsh reality, but has to be done. So when it comes to play-by-play for Pokemon, are we talking about like, because again, I'm trying to visualize it. I don't remember if I've heard it quite yet, but are we talking about like humongous like shouting? Like, oh my God, this thing happened and that thing happened. And
it kind of, I think okay. So. I think like there are casters that have come before me that shaped what we know today as modern Pokemon casting. There were broadcasting companies like Critical Hit GG, which is one of the other talents, like production children, I want to say, like they own the company and they go around to some of the other grassroots streams and have really helped to bring up casters like myself, because I worked with them first before I got scouted by the Pokemon company to be brought on for that NAIC 2019 show. But also Nugget Bridge is where a lot of the other top tier Pokemon casters came from, like the elite of the elite. But we are definitely entering into a new era where a lot of those Nugget Bridge casters aren't on events anymore. And we've brought up some more new faces that really are kind of changing the way that we look at commentary. Because it used to be very professional, broadcast strict, you know, blazer, suit and tie kind of deal. But we're slowly changing that, where maybe we're changing up the wardrobe bit by bit so it's not so stringent, and we are getting towards more of the, you know, how do I want to put, like streetwear broadcast look, I guess.
Okay,
like you still have the elements of being professional, but you can still show your own personality with what you're wearing. But then also how you approach it, because I was really the first person that came on that was looking at a full-time career in broadcasting. Everyone else was grassroots players and streamers that had been scouted for the same reasons, but, you know, didn't necessarily look at it from an overarching esports perspective of League of Legends or Overwatch, or, you know, how some of the other tier one titles really look at how broadcasting should be done. So it's been a very slow transition, but we're getting there and we are starting to evolve the craft.
That's fascinating, because Pokemon, despite being the oldest, one of the oldest competitive, I suppose, sports, is obviously different levels of competitiveness, and then really didn't accept kind of like the label of esports. It felt like for a very long time. You know, I suppose you could say, you know, dueling someone with Game Boys was esports, but got to add some of the flair to it, right?
Yes.
Some of the prestige, the casters, the production. So it is kind of a new sport, and it's also not a typical to esports, because the action that flows for a game like that, as well as like for TFT, which I guess would be more akin to chess, is not what we're going to be growing up hearing from the radio. Right. So I think there's a lot of like things that FPS casters or even an RTS like me can still take from those learnings, you know, whether you're intentful or not, being like, oh, the broadcaster sounds like this, they do this, that can't really be done with the slower paced games, the turn based games. So I guess you would have to look at maybe chess. I don't know what you guys are looking at. But anyways, like there's got to be some type of model out there, but it's not going to be as popular. So you guys are in that development. You're in the awkward teenage phase, which is
still
kind of exciting.
Kind of. Yeah, still. I mean, Nugget Bridge casters, that really kicked off Pokemon commentary as we know it, had actually drawn up blueprints almost of what is to be expected when you were casting. So there's still like the Reddit archives of some of those founding Nugget Bridge members that where they talked about, you know, their own individual approach to Pokemon commentary. But, you know, even I'm looking at it from, you know, I started off as like the super hype, excited about everything, shouting about everything type of play-by-play that I have grown to understand might not be the top tier of commentary that I want to aspire to be, into more of one that, you know, I understand the ebbs and flows of when you should get excited. Okay, you can't get excited about everything. Every mm-hmm. critical hit doesn't actually matter. Every knockout doesn't actually matter if you can look 6 or 7 turns ahead to realize that maybe a knockout here onto a Pokemon actually doesn't net them anything and, in fact, could be detrimental. Mm-hmm. And so you find those ways to insert that nuance of maybe I would have. Old me would have gotten excited about this, but I know better now to be able to realize that I need to build up the suspense and build up the hype so it's not just a wall of sound with me and my co-caster. Also, if I'm too loud, then my color caster sounds quiet when they come back and they're not excited about things because I realize, oh, right, I got excited about something I should not have, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Different energy levels, right? Yeah. Yeah, which, I mean, sometimes is because one person is wrong. And other times can actually just be like a chemistry issue, you know, where a lot of color commentators absolutely, especially if they're not familiar with broadcasting, are always like this. And the play-by-play and them have to have a little conversation, you know, and be like, look, dude, like match the energy like a little bit. Yeah, sometimes it's incorrect too. And I think what you're talking about is making sure that a story has like all of the parts that we would understand a story to have and isn't just literally trying to have, you know, a dozen action scenes back to back to back. There's the intro and the details and the world building.
Exactly.
And yeah, so that when a climax actually happens, it's something actually exciting and unique. So kind of on that subject, that's like a broad view of commentating. As a play-by-play commentator, since you have experience in both, I'm going to ask about both, but as a part-time play-by-play commentator, did you have a lot of trouble controlling your voice, getting the little micro aspects of just being a good speaker? Yeah. What did you identify and what have you done to work on it?
I know that naturally I am a very loud individual. And so a lot of what I had to work on was actually controlling my breathing so that I didn't sound like I was yelling or screaming too much about something hype that was happening on screen. And so a lot of that was working with my diaphragm to ensure that also the sound was nice and round and warm. And so I wasn't pitchy and like, you know, like mousy about what I was talking about because nobody wants to listen to that either. There's a time and a place for it, but it's not every single time. But yeah, so definitely trying to get that under control to make sure that when I was talking, it was pleasant to listen to. Was a big deal. So that's where a lot of the VOD review would come in. And sometimes it wouldn't be focusing in on what I was saying, but how. Because that was really important to me, especially as a woman play-by-play caster. I feel like I get a lot of sometimes fair, sometimes unjust criticism that I am just loud and obnoxious to listen to.
Yes. That could be a very difficult part of, I guess, our lives. Really, anyone with a feminine voice, actually, because I know there are some men who also have to work on similar mm-hmm. things, like being too pitchy or too screechy. Something that doesn't really seem to be a problem for someone who's like in a death metal band. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so, that's true.
They're just different things to work on. But yeah, the criticism of like, well, am I actually being unpleasant to talk to hear, or is this like some deep-rooted sexism from a guy on the internet? Is honestly a debate you have to have. You're like, give it a little bit of credit. Hold on, let me think it through. Okay, no, this guy's just stupid, or he's correct, you know, whatever. But anywho, so I think that's a really important point to bring up is the way that you present what you're trying to say is so easy to the miscommunication is rampant in our daily lives. But especially mm-hmm. when you have a certain amount of time and no feedback at the time, right?
Yeah.
So that the viewers can't be like, what did you mean by that? And you say, oh, hold on, let me explain. that's never going to happen.
Yeah, you don't have that.
Yeah. At best, maybe your co-caster can give you a little bit of a nudge to help you kind of clarify. But even then, if it's just the way you sound, can be difficult to examine and fix. So do you remember anything in particular that you were like, I didn't really get what I wanted to deliver there? Do you have any fine examples?
So a great example of this is that actually, like, my Overwatch League color casting. Okay. So I remembered I had a huge tendency to ramble about what I wanted to say, and I wouldn't really get straight to the point, or I would say my point, but realize later that I needed to expand upon it to really get the viewer to understand the more finite and nuanced things of the main overarching point. So I was told by Uber, actually, to follow X, Y, then Z. Just kind of a generic formula of your point, maybe a little bit something else, and then go deeper. Especially when it comes to maybe influencing a team fight. This is the little culprit before. I'm just going to hold on to him so that he can't walk behind my desk and turn the mic off again. But yeah, that's really where I feel like a lot of my growth has had to come is delivery of how I'm saying things, and also the content of what I'm saying needs to be more precise.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think a great color commentator is able to wrap everything up in a nice package so that the play-by-play can attach a bow to it. Yeah. That's how I would look at it, right?
So I love that.
Yeah, thank you. But because it's something that I know, it was something that I didn't really identify, could think of, like, why does this feel good when it would happen with me, right? Like, my co-caster would set me up and I could tie it into a bow, or vice versa. I'd kind of get the point across decently well, and then my co-caster would be like, blah, blah, blah. I'd be like,
yep,
exactly. So I think a lot about these things. But it's also part of the chemistry that can be included there. But right, being concise, being accurate as much as possible, especially in a fast-paced game, which we didn't really touch on the fact that you're on basically two extremes of casting here. You have Pokemon, which is turn-based, and then you have Overwatch, which is on crack constantly. Yeah. So that's something. So how did that initially work out? You know, how did you initially kind of grasp the pacing when you first got into, I guess, Overwatch casting for maybe Contenders?
So I think that's where a lot of my pain points growing as a Pokemon caster actually stemmed from. For Overwatch, I feel like it's really important for you to have two well-defined roles as play-by-play and color, and there doesn't happen to be as much overlap for banter or the back and forth that you might want to have a bit more conversationally in a slower paced game like Pokemon. And so I very quickly had to become more comfortable with the idea of, I talk here, this is where I talk, and I shut up as soon as the action starts to happen. Or, like, you know, you got to wrap up your point super fast so you can throw over and you don't get off kilter with where your play-by-play would want to take things. And so that's definitely something that I've had to be more conscious of as a color caster in Overwatch. When do I stop and when do I throw? Trying to be a bit more predictive of where my play-by-play might want to start picking up and talking about something. Whereas in Pokemon, I feel like I've gotten way more comfortable being more fluid. So we do have a bit more of a hybrid approach. One, that comes with the pacing of the game changing so drastically, but also me becoming way more comfortable with the game knowledge that I have and how to accurately talk about it. Because it wasn't that I was bad at the game. In 2019, I was just on a break, and I also really didn't understand how to get my message across, especially concisely. So yeah. That's been a weird way to kind of have to balance the two.
Yeah. I think that is another aspect of commentating that people don't really get to think through until they do it. Because there's plenty of examples of people, well, especially pro gamers, but people who are very good at the game, who try broadcasting, and besides the obvious mistakes, the uhs, the ums, the hold on, what I meant was, I do think they even get kind of thrown off a little bit on the predicting game that can happen, with commentating, you've been talking about getting that knowledge of what can happen next in the game is great. But then also even a little bit of like that chemistry being like, I kind of can predict what this guy is going to, what he's going to come in with or whatever it is. So I think that's very much something that many people have built just by years of commentating and they just kind of do it almost naturally. And now it's the point to talk about that kind of predictive nature of commentating, the way that you can put something to, I guess, like a finite detail, but then add like caveats and leave room for stories and even errors that don't make you just fall flat on your face.
Oh, that's such a good point. I feel like there have been many instances where I've put my foot in my mouth by being too adamant that this specific thing is going to happen. And then when it doesn't, you just kind of look like a fool. There are some great people that can recover from that well. I feel like Sideshow is actually a fantastic example of this. He's so smart, but he's also very charismatic when he makes a specific assumption that like he can get away with it, you know, like because he was so confident in what he said that even if it doesn't happen, he still looks smart. If that makes sense.
I know exactly what you're saying, because Sideshow absolutely, as a commentator, he is very much a definitive facts, like I know this, I was studying this.
Yes.
And then, you know, it turns out not to be the case because other people play incorrectly, honestly, or just simply make a forced error, or he did make a gaffe, you know, he read 69 as 72, whatever, and he's able to fix it. So I think it's a great example. As someone who, of course, will make mistakes or will have foot and mouth disease, but then is able to recover very well. And him working with Bryn obviously very much helps as well. Yeah, I have a great, great casting team. Definitely a good pickup for Valorant. Okay, so yeah, the pacing, changing of pacing between the two is actually kind of amazing that you are able to flex in that way. It's fantastic.
Love practice.
Yeah, a lot of practice, I guess, would be the way to do it. So let's see here. We have Pokemon, we have Overwatch. You said you did Hearthstone a little bit as well. Was there anything else that you've been dabbling in? Have you thought about working in other games, or right now are you kind of okay with where you're at?
Well, it's funny because I do hosting for TFT as well. So that's okay. Where I've really been doing a lot of my, professional work with Bupasaurus. Has been from being on the TFT broadcasts as a host. And so that's like a whole different skill set you have to have in order to be able to do that. And so that's been kind of fun to learn as well. Being able to have all of, I guess, maybe smaller bits of knowledge. It's a double-edged sword to me. I like that I have the experience so that I know what maybe another one of my broadcast mates is focusing on, so that if I'm on an analyst desk, then I know like maybe where the host needs to go in order to really drive the conversation, so I can be a bit more mindful of that, or you know, be doing play-by-play and also doing color for different games helps me to understand the vice versa when I switch games. But it's also, I feel like I haven't really been able to master any one particular craft. And so I would love to say that like I could be a top play-by-play caster or top color caster, but I feel like when I have to switch roles a lot, I am not able to give my 110% to mastering it as fast as I would like to. I still think I have a lot to go.
That's, first of all, I don't think anyone can actually, I don't think anyone is saying they're a master of something.
That's one, I guess that's true.
One problem. Even those who are considered the best in the industry you'll find them tearing up in a after party because they think they're a total failure, and you're like, what is happening?
Yeah, it's like, what are you? No way.
Yeah. Anyways, but it's obviously an ambition to be really good, and usually focusing on one thing is a good way to do it. But you kind of led into a question that sometimes I ask, you know, the question of, is it more beneficial to have that range or is it not, right? And I think that can be really two questions, because there's the beneficial range as in employment, which I think is undeniably good. Like if you can do everything, then that's good. I don't think there's really an argument against it. But then there's the perfecting your craft argument, which you're on the side of, you wish you could focus on one thing, right? Yeah, yes. I actually found that when I got into hosting, I found that I actually thought it improved my commentary. So I'm also curious, do you think that doing multiple games has helped your commentary, or do you wish you could focus on one?
I think that so first off, I have no regrets of how like the trajectory of my career has gone from starting with Overwatch to broadening really fast and just kind of accepting whatever opportunity came my way. I know that is maybe not everybody would agree with me in terms of how maybe I did get my start, because I think that there are those camps that it's better to focus on one thing and be really good at that one thing. But I found it really helpful for my career that I was open to whatever came my way. Yeah. I think it allowed me to maybe have that more, or I guess more of a quickened start than what maybe some of the other, some other casters have had. But also I feel like it was also kind of a matter of circumstance where I started right before the pandemic and right before things were moved remotely. And so I was maybe with the eagerness of being able to say yes to a lot of things did have a couple more doors open. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just trying to be more introspective of like, well, yeah, it is kind of weird. It is really weird because I don't know many other people that I guess, huh. Yeah, long story short, I think diversification was good for me to get my foot into the door for being a broadcast talent. Mm-hmm. However, it led to burnout because I was doing so many different games and so many different roles that I never really felt like I was swimming. I felt like I was drowning or drowning for a lot of my, I guess, time, even just a year and a half ago. So getting Overwatch League was such a big blessing, because I could focus way more on just two or three things instead of, at one point in time, I was doing PUBG, TFT, Fortnite, Overwatch, Pokemon. Like, I think I was doing 7 or 8 games at a time. It was too much. It was way too much.
Yeah. Drowning gracefully, though.
Oh, thank you.
But that sounds like that would be overwhelming. But as you said, like, it, you know, no regrets for it. I think that it helps you learn your limits. You do, by trial by fire, learn how to do a bunch of different games, somewhat, you know, I guess adequately. I don't know, or really, really great. I don't know what your perspective would be on your individual performances, but hopefully they were all certainly good enough that if you ever did want to go into one of those avenues once again, that it would be open for you.
I hope so. I don't know. It's hard because, like, I will always look at myself under a more critical lens than other people. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm super hypercritical of myself. And so when I look at the experiences, at least, that I've had for other games, it's a blessing because I think, one, I know what I like doing and I don't like doing. I got a better idea of conditions that are acceptable versus unacceptable to work in. And also, hearing other people and being around so many other broadcast talent, I get to kind of pick up like a sponge all of these different things that I actually really like about maybe PUBG casting that I feel like could translate really well over to Overwatch or something like that. So it's kind of nice to be able to have that as well, because I feel like you learn way more being in the moment than even just watching VODs.
Of course.
Sometimes.
I absolutely agree with that. And I, as I said, I think that working a variety of jobs as well as a variety of games is basically beneficial as long as you're not drowning, which
I think it's good up until a certain point. I definitely. Yeah. I think I went past the point where it was a good thing.
Right. Yeah. So much of a good thing. But you brought up how like hypercritical you are. And I think that's pretty much blanket for a lot of people. But I've not asked this question before, but if you're open for it, can you discuss some of the things that you've been recently critical of yourself and what you're doing to improve on them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that I think the biggest problem that I ever had was I was so critical to the point that I was never happy coming off of a broadcast. And there have been maybe a handful of times that I've come off of a broadcast and been actually really happy with the product, which is a good and a bad thing. I think it's a good thing because I can use that as a really great example of this was a broadcast where I felt 95% of what I did was what I want to do every single time. But then, you know, on the flip side of things, if you're too critical, then sometimes you miss those moments where you are actually really happy with it, but it's being drowned out by all of these other things that you're focusing on as being problems. I think that being hypercritical has allowed me to be a bit better at looking at something where I can improve. And I'm trying so hard not to be as critical, but I keep focusing, especially on times where maybe I say something stupid or I think is really stupid, and trying to ignore it. But I'm finding that sometimes it's better to kind of call it out. Or at least for me personally, I've been a little bit better about calling it out on broadcasts. If like Overwatch League cast recently, I read something that was happening in the match chat between the players, and I said, oh, Kalouge said, called out that they did a C9. But that's not actually what he said at all. And so we came back. I was like, I actually said good round. I'm just an idiot, and I couldn't read that, you know? But it's like sometimes you need to be a little bit better about making fun of yourself.
Right. Yeah.
Not take yourself so seriously.
Sure. And that, I think it allows the time to acknowledge it and deal with it, that if you don't, you get off the mic and then you start thinking about it and then it starts snowballing in your brain and you start thinking about it way too much.
Yes. That was, you summed up what I wanted to say way better than what I spent 5 minutes just saying.
No worries. No worries. But yeah, that's something that I've had to deal with, especially like, you know, certain times in your life when you're feeling even 10% more anxious, when you're on a broadcast and everything you say is kind of stuck in time. You know, there's not much time to, you literally can't delete it. It's on the internet forever, but there's also not much time in the moment to fix it either. So you kind of have to accept your losses. And so that 10% like more anxiety, it turns into like, you know, 100% more anxiety.
It does.
It's so easy. It's so easy. And you're definitely not the first commentator that I've talked to that has said they don't like most of the commentary that they do, right? Like right after the moment. Right. I've had a bit of this problem as well, where it's kind of weird because personally, I will end a broadcast and for 10 minutes be like, oh, glad that's done. Let me go to the bathroom. Let me get my water, you know, the usual necessities. But then right after, just be like, God, I really didn't feel good. Like, I didn't feel good. I didn't do this. I didn't recognize that. And I remember thinking this after broadcasts, 2 years ago or something like that. But when I think of it overall, so Katowice 2022, earlier this year, I was the same. I actually had an anxiety attack during it. It was a very stressful moment. But I thought that it was such a bad time for most of my commentary at the time. But now when I look back on it, it's this weird effect of like, well, I looked really good there and I did this really well.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know. I don't know if that helps anyone out there have to try and like think through these things, but even from like a kid, my kind of goal would always be like, if I messed up, I didn't study for a test, I would always think, well, in 2 weeks, will this really matter? When like 2 months, will this really matter?
No, it's so true. I think what really amplifies that feeling though, and not being able to get to that place of it's not going to matter in 2 or 3 weeks, is that there's constant pressure being in the spotlight and being in such a public facing job. Because people are looking at every single move that you make.
Yeah.
And I think that when I started and I was getting all this criticism for Pokemon, it made me more cautious about what I was saying and how people would perceive it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got way in my head about it because there would be people that would take things out of context and then say, you know, like, well, you're so stupid because you said this when in reality XYZ was happening and you just missed it. And it's like, I know. Like, and you just like, you agree with them and you're like, yeah, I messed up. And like, oh no, what else have I said? And I'm the type of person that allows that to really spiral out of control.
Yeah.
But that definitely led to being more cautious.
Right. Yeah, we definitely change the way that we can say things, again, to give us almost an allowance of like, you know, how much of a screw up does it really look like? How much was it really a screw up? But I think that is absolutely the added stress to our job, is that for me, it's like every cast I do, there's someone's first impression of me there, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so really hard to get rid of a first impression. So as you were saying, some people who can think critically and still post on YouTube comments, which is surprising, but still they will say like, oh, she's gotten a lot better. And that's a beautiful feeling, because that's also probably coinciding with this idea that they're usually very hard to convince afterwards, because I think that is true. And that's why it's such a good feeling.
Yes, that exactly is, you know, after I received all of that criticism from Pokemon, I thought it was lost. I really thought that audience that watched that broadcast would never look at me as a strong broadcast talent ever again, because it was the same people commenting over and over about, I don't like her. Why is she still a caster when she did this 2 years ago? You know, and they would call on something very specific, and that's really like, I would never be able to get away from it. I said that you could... Something about Pokemon typing and remembering all 18 types and their interactions with each other is very difficult. And sometimes in the moment, you do make mistakes. I will be the first to admit that I said it. I called later that it was a mistake on that broadcast, but people don't remember that. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, it's like I gotta own up to it and try to move forward. But I really thought, from how many people for 2.5 years were saying the same things and calling back on the same moments, I just thought that it was a lost cause. And I was prepared at one point that I might not have a popular Pokemon career because of those people that would constantly look back to exhibits A and B.
Yeah, just loop back around. It's tough. Must have been a plague the entire, you know, 2 years. Glad that you got through it. And now you have, I think when those people do turn over, their respect for you really does shoot through the roof. So there's, I guess, that to consider. But it's also, I think, the really difficult thing about being a caster who does move around, or host a little less so, because I just feel like hosts often fill a role that is most not remembered. Like, but not to get into that too much. That you, when you move through the different games, your chances to kind of average out is lower, right? So if you knock out of the park in one thing, then people remember 100%. But if you kind of were off that day, then they're going to remember you at your 30%, and that's it. But if you have a steady career, like an Overwatch League, then hopefully those bad days and those good days kind of average out and you have more good days.
That's hopefully the hope. I think that happened. I do think that happened. I can distinctly remember days in Overwatch League where I did not do well, and I felt like the comments on Reddit backed that up. Mm-hmm. Then there are the days where I felt like I did pretty okay, and like that's the average performance that I'd like to put out in the world, and people do remember that as like, oh yeah, like, hey, that was better than this day. And it's like, okay, cool. I'm happy you said that, because that's the goal, right?
Yeah.
Is at the end of the day, trying to keep up the improvement and try to make sure that you are living up to expectations, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and people give you the benefit of the doubt as well, the more that you're on. So they'll look back to a good day and be like, well, they knew it then, so they just kind of forgot, or something happened today. Again, if they're nice people and critical thinkers.
Yes.
Which sometimes isn't the case. Anyways, we do have the end of the podcast coming up here, so I will ask you our Patreon question for today, and that is going to be from Barrett. What characters/Pokemon do you enjoy commentating the most?
I like the non-meta Pokemon. That's my favorite because I feel like sometimes there are players that will always bring something spicy. And so, you know, maybe it's like an unstandard build or it's a unique strategy of how they might individually approach the game. And it's just fun to see that creative type of thinking because there's a lot of metas in Pokemon where it feels like you're not allowed to think outside the box because that'll just lose you the game. Uh-huh. But when you find those players that can carve in that opportunity to do something unique, like Seijin Park winning Worlds with Pachirisu is probably the moment that sticks out to people the most. Because Pachirisu is not a Pokemon I think you would ever see on a standard team ever again. It's probably not going to happen. But the fact that he did it in a meta where everything was kind of the same team, the same build, the same approach and thinking is really, I think, what makes that moment stick out to a lot of people. So I like finding those and being able to help shape the history of Pokemon in that way, too.
I once asked another Pokemon caster how many Pokemon are like meta or like usable. And I forget what she said, but I also forget how many Pokemon there are now.
So. There's over 920. Oh, and in any meta, I feel like it depends on like the mechanic at the time. But as of right now, or as it was at Worlds in 2022, 2 months ago. Yeah, because we're out of the format now. We might have seen 60.
Whoa. Okay.
It's always a very small sample size, but it always gets worse as the formats get harder.
Sure. Okay, so. Yeah. That is a crazy small percentage, though. Okay. Yeah. And just my question based off kind of that one anyways, it's like I didn't think about this, but do your favorite Pokemon, just the ones that you're like, that's a neat Pokemon, influence your enjoyment from casting and vice versa? There's something you like casting and so you like it more.
Oh yeah, 100%. I'm biased. Let's be honest about that, is that it's fun when you see something that you also find fun. And I think like Overwatch League is a great example of this too. I did not like the Junker Queen meta.
Gotcha.
Didn't enjoy it. I thought it was boring. Everyone and every team was running the exact same thing. And so I absolutely got more excited and more animated when I saw a team running something that wasn't the Junker Queen 5. Like, that's just how it is. Yeah, absolutely. If I see a Sylveon on another team, I'm going to be excited for that person.
Nice.
I might not be good at filtering it out either, and I accept this.
What is your favorite Pokemon?
Definitely Sylveon.
Gotcha. Okay. I was thinking that might be the answer. Yeah. So a new one that I'm actually not very familiar with.
There's so many of them, but I think that's like the good and bad thing. There's something for everybody, but you might not know what everyone's favorite is.
Oh, okay. I've seen this one. Gotcha. It is cute. It was cute. Okay. And that's going to be the end of the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on, Necra, giving us some insight into your very, very fast-tracked career. Excellent job entering into the world of esports. Excellent job. It's actually kind of, we didn't get to touch on it, but you know, your possible lack of StarCraft, but esports history would probably disturb me. But
I was going to say, no, that's actually such a valid comment too. Everybody, I feel like, had a hand in StarCraft at some point.
Yeah.
You name the broadcaster in esports, they've done something with StarCraft. I've done probably a single cheese Adelphia and that's it.
Oh, that's
right. My StarCraft.
Oh my God, I totally forgot about that. I totally blanked. But yeah,
enough to me. Like that
count. I think Fear Dragon suggested you actually like a year ago, because he was like, yeah, she did cheese Adelphia. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then just kind of had other guests. Actually, I took a hiatus for a little while, but yeah, that is awesome. But no, I don't mean to rag on you, maybe little bit for fun, but it's the fact that someone comes in, you know, and they're just completely detached from the wild, wild west of esports. And especially for your case, you didn't even, fortunately, I'm saying this is a good thing, you didn't have to go through like the being scammed all the time, you know, not getting paid, paid 5 days late, getting told you're going to do something and then not getting something done. And
yeah,
that might happen to you, unfortunately, but less so than the old days.
It's happened, but not as much. And, you know, when I compare my own personal experiences to the veterans of the esports industry, they're very different. I have definitely worked under way better conditions than what I have heard only stories of, but like countless stories of, you know, working out of a bedroom with three other people and, you know, not getting paid very much. And just like I admire and I cherish the people that paved the way of esports so that people like myself could not worry so much.
Right. Yeah.
It means a lot.
So. It could be part of like an actual industry as opposed to just a bunch of fools gathering around doing stuff. It's awesome. Obviously, that's the reason that they did it. I don't really consider myself a starter, you know, but maybe like a Gen 2 or a Gen 3.
Pokemon still analogies. Helping to pave the way to make sure that like us Zoomer folk, I'm not actually a Zoomer though. I'm old enough I'm a millennial, but
yeah.
I guess like I would consider myself in the esports talent industry a Zoomer of
that's
some
accurate.
Kind.
That I think that actually might be accurate. The new gen man's gonna take us forward. But yeah, so what are you doing in the near future? Do you stream YouTube stuff? Anything?
Yeah,
any
I do. I guess I'm trying to get back into streaming. So, but everything is Necra, which is kind of weird to say. But you can find me on every platform as Necra.
the amazing, I guess, unique enough name that you got it on everything.
Yes, that is fantastic. I got the gauntlet. It's kind of wild.
Got the Infinity Stones, YouTube, Twitch. Yeah, okay. Great. So I guess we'll see you more on Overwatch League and Pokemon in the future as well.
I hope
everything's,
so.
boot up and any other esport that apparently you are very capable of diving into. So great job. Thanks again for coming on. And thanks to everyone out there who's listening and watching. I always mess up the transition to talking to you guys. Sorry about that. I do have some shout outs for all the Patreon supporters, patreon.com/zombiegrub. Thank you to Shane and Vlad Ivy, or Vlad 4, for co-producing their podcast, and Barrett for helping to organize and reach out to people. And thank you to the people on Patreon who support above and beyond. We got Nick, Vinny, Steven, E.T., Ruvy, Barrett, and Cuddle Bunny. Thank you guys so much. And that'll do it for episode 60. I got that right now. And I'll see you guys next time for episode 61. Bye-bye.